Economics is the study of human choice in the world we live. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By investigating faith in economics, we can learn how they lead to human flourishing. This is the Faith in Economics Podcast, a presentation of the Gortney Institute at Ottawa University.
Welcome to our show today. I'm Ken Ugarteche, producer and graduate assistant for the Gortney Institute. Dr. Ross McCullough, the founder of the Gortney Institute and Wayne Angel Chair of Economics. Dr. Justin Clark, the Menard Family Professor of Philosophy and Ethics. Finally, Dr. Peter Jacobson, the Gortney Professor of Economic Education and Research.
All right, so today we want to talk about deflation. And there's been so much inflation around, and there's a lot of confusion, but yet support on an economy not wanting to have deflation for some reason. And so I'd like to pop a bubble in that, or pop the bubble on that. Maybe there's not a bubble to be popped, but I want to kind of say my piece on this. So I told my class today, actually, and like, I like low prices. What's wrong with low prices? And so where does this, you know, notion even come from that inflation, a low and stable inflation, is you know, necessary or desirable for a healthy economy? And so what we've seen over this last inflationary period here in the United States over the last couple of years is, you know, rising almost as high as 10%. We're starting to approach 4%, but we still have more inflation to wring out, or to more money to wring out of the system, so to speak, because of the relationship of inflation and the money supply. And prices aren't going down, folks. I think a lot of people think, you know, the news reports come out that say, oh, the inflation rate's down. Well, if it goes down from 6% to 4%, that means your prices on the shelves are still going up by 4%. It's just lower than what it would have been had it been 6%. And so if you're hoping for the days of a dollar cheeseburger at McDonald's to come back, they're gone. They're not coming back unless there was actually true deflation, which means negative inflation. So we need the prices to not fall down to the Federal Reserve's target of 2% inflation. It would actually have to be targeted to be negative 2% or negative 4% to actually get down to the levels we were at just 3 years ago. But, you know, if we look at COVID prices, for instance, we'd literally have to see deflation in place. And that's just not going to happen with the powers of the Fed and the incentives that are in place. Maybe I'll pause there, let you guys jump in. Yeah, Justin.
Yeah, so I think it's important to try to explain what we mean by deflation.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms that a normal person can understand. So yes. I'm going to try to do this.
I was so excited I couldn't even define it. I'm usually good about doing that. So
I'm going to do this from my perspective, and then you guys can tell me if I get anything wrong.
All right. All right.
Because unlike you guys, I'm a normal person.
I don't know about that.
When maybe I have a closer to a normal person's understanding of economics terms.
Fair enough.
That's probably wrong too. One of the things that's confusing when people talk about inflation and deflation is that inflation gets used in two different senses. It gets used in the sense of price inflation, meaning the average level of price rises over time. Things cost more. And it also gets used sometimes when people talk about expansion of the monetary base, or they talk about M2 growing or something. And that's monetary supply inflation. And these two things often go together, but they often get used in two different ways, right? Monetary inflation often causes price inflation. But when we talk about deflation, we're almost always talking just about the decrease in relative prices, right? We're not talking about shrinking the money supply. Usually, that's what people usually mean by deflation.
And not to confuse people, when you're saying money inflation, you're really just talking about the rate of money growth, right? Like if the Federal Reserve printed the printing press and they ramped it up from 4% more money out in the system to 6% more money out in the system, is that what you meant by money inflation?
not rate of money growth, just growth in the money supply, right? Because the rate of growth is an increase of the rate of growth is like a derivative of that, right?
So yeah, one year's higher than the next, the new year's number minus the old year's number divided by the old year's number, just to kind of do a simple rate of growth of the money supply. And that ends up being connected to price growth.
Yeah, if the money supply grows, that's an inflation of the money supply, in my view. Not if it grows at a greater rate than it did the year before. That's a growth. That's an increase.
I'm just going to bite my tongue because this is supposed to be the non-econ version. So roll, baby, roll.
Yeah. So if we had an economy with a money supply that stayed the same, right? A money supply that didn't grow. And we also thought that the amount of goods and services in the economy, that is the economy, was growing, then we would have more goods and more services and the same amount of currency. And that typically we would think would result in deflation, in the sense that prices would be lower because we have the same amount of currency and more goods. Is that correct so far?
So there's one way in which you could still have inflation or deflation, which would depend on like people's demand to hold dollars, right? And so if you had an increased demand to hold dollars, you could have deflation. If you had a decreased demand, then you could have inflation. But the main building blocks, if people's demand for dollars is pretty consistent, then you're right.
Sometimes people like throw money velocity in here too, right?
Yeah, that's what he's referring
to. The money velocity to economists is the inverse of the desire to hold money, basically.
Yeah. But usually when economists say there hasn't been any price inflation, it's because prices have stayed relatively the same, even though the amount of goods and services has increased, like GDP has gone up, right? And I think in an economy with a money supply that remains the same, as we have been talking about, you would expect deflation to occur because the goods and services have gone up while the money supply has remained relatively stable, right? With these perturbations.
Yeah, and any year where the GDP is, the growth in real GDP is greater than the growth, the price level, that would have been true, right? Or greater than the growth in the money supply, then that definitely would have been true. Like, we could say for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it kind of seems like the books are already cooked in favor of at least some kind of inflation.
Yes.
Where, no, what counts as no inflation really just means we're increasing the monetary supply enough so that prices stay relatively stable, even though the amount of goods is increasing too.
Right.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong here too, but the common view in economics is that even that is not enough inflation. We need more inflation than that. We need the actual relative rate of prices to increase at about 2% a year. That's the target.
Yeah.
So we need to increase the money supply more than enough just to keep prices stable. Yeah. What we mean by stable is going up a little bit every year.
And let me go back to the 0% thing, because I think that's a good baseline to start with, is that if the rate of growth of the money supply equals your rate of growth of the economy, then you will have 0% inflation. And to me, Peter and I would be in a minority of economists that would say that's a good thing even. And I think it's great that if we had that situation, imagine a grocery cart of can of tomato soup and a bag of Oreos and Doritos cost the same 30 years ago as it does today. I mean, I think that's a pretty neat world to live in, honestly. It kind of gives us a lot of stability and other things. So I think we can deal with prices going down too. But that is where somebody like John Taylor was an economist that came up with having a fixed rule. And like you say, most economists, I don't know if Taylor would or not with the 2% thing, but it's kind of gravitated. It's almost like you're inculcated with this 2% mindset. And maybe a little bit later, we'll get into where I think that the incentives are for 2%. But Peter, what do you think on that?
Yeah, so this is maybe takes us into a little bit too much detail, but I think I'll give like what I think is the best case against deflation. And so the common case against deflation is that when prices go down, people lose their jobs. This is like the very like common line is that, like, look at all of our deflationary periods in history. Those periods are also the recessionary and depressionary periods in history. And like, this is a pretty bad argument. The reason it's a pretty bad argument is that, like, it's not the causal relationship goes the other way.
Right.
It's not the deflation that's causing the depression or recession. It's the depression or recession that's causing the deflation. That's my take on it. But here's the best arguments against a certain type of deflation. So this is, like, famously put out by, like, folks like George Selgin, people who are in favor of free banking. What they argue is there's two types of deflation. One type of deflation is the deflation that comes from the supply of goods and services increasing because the economy is getting more productive. And Selgin says that's good, and we shouldn't try to avoid that kind of deflation. He says that generates no problems, so we shouldn't have any responses to it.
Okay, good.
The other type of deflation is the deflation related to the recessions and depressions that Selgin says, well, what about the deflation that comes from the fact that people just have an increased demands to hold money? They're not being satisfied in their money balances. And I don't mean wealth. So for the listeners at home, obviously everybody wants more money in the broad sense of the term. But when I say you're increasing your demand to hold money, what I mean is you're increasing the balances of, like, your checking account or the dollars in your wallet or even, like, the balance in your savings account, really. All of those things are, like, a demand to hold money instead of, like, investing in things or purchasing things. That's kind of the dichotomy here. And so what Selgin says is if you just have an increased demand to hold money in, like, a checking account or in your wallets, then what that's going to do is it's going to mean people are buying less goods and services, right? And so that decrease in the purchasing of goods and services, because wages are relatively sticky, this is a second argument, because people have contracts where their wage is agreed upon, when companies start getting less revenue from people purchasing because they're holding more money, they can't just lower everyone's wages to compensate for the fact that they aren't bringing in as much revenue as they used to because the wages are sticky. And so they end up firing people. And as people get fired, people start to get afraid and they start to hold on to more money. And so this creates a vicious cycle. Now, this is the argument against deflation or a certain type of deflation that Selgin makes. I think it's a decent argument. The one thing I point out about this argument is even in that version of deflation, deflation is still not the primary cause. It's not the thing that really caused the issue. The thing that caused the issue is whatever caused people to desire to basically hold more cash, hold more dollar bills. I agree that, like, if everybody suddenly decided they just wanted to hold a bunch of dollar bills, this could result in a recession or a depression. But the question is, why would everybody simultaneously do that? And if you find that, you find the real source of the issue. But I agree with Selgin insofar as deflation involves holding on to extra dollar bills, and that's, like, the only source. Then we can imagine that it would be good to increase the supply of money so that way people have access to more dollar bills to hold on to. Does that make sense? Is, like, the steel?
Yeah, price? I mean, that's probably the best argument I've heard. I don't agree with it, but yeah, I think I see the logic, and I think my disagreement might be something that would be good to come into the second half with. So we'll pick up there in just a bit.
Ottawa University has an exciting new major, PPE, which stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Each of these fields is interesting in their own right, but they intersect in ways that are important to understand, both individually and for your community. If you find philosophy fascinating but want to make sure that your study of the subject is practical, if you enjoy economic analysis but want to see how economic laws interact with moral principles, if you are interested in politics but want to explore how economic and ethical realities constrain our political choices, you should consider the PPE program at Ottawa University.
This spring, Ottawa University is organizing a PPE League competition for politics, philosophy, and economics. Students in this competition will compete leveraging the ideas of philosophy, politics, and economics in various events. If you're a professor or an advisor of college students and you're interested in your school competing in PPE League this spring, contact Peter, Justin, or Russ today.
By 2030, the Gortney Institute will be known for its alumni, supporters, and participants who incorporate economic understanding with their faith in their careers, vocations, communities, and personal lives. We have some great programming going on for high school students. We have an online microeconomics class. Yes, you can earn college credit for $200 by taking an online class. It's affordable, flexible, layered with support. Our new online micro is optimized for you. If you'd like to consider some events for your high school students or that class, please contact Justin, Peter, or Russ today. Okay, so we're back, and during break, we thought it'd be good for Peter to frame up the issue again so that I can crush it. So, Peter, frame up the Selgin argument.
Yeah, so the Selgin argument is that if suddenly there's an increase in demand for dollars, like other markets, when there's an increase in demand for something, we should have an increase in supply to make up for that increase in demand. And so what Selgin says is, in a free banking system where there's private companies that produce money, higher demands would lead to higher supply. And if we don't have higher supply, then we're going to have a painful price adjustment period where people lose jobs. That's his argument.
Okay. And it would be something along the lines of more volatility in interest rates because of the fixed supply. There'd be more volatility maybe in a free banking system, which, again, that's a whole podcast if we wanted to get into that, but the supply would change. Okay, I get you. All right. So I think people are probably equally complacent with a 2% rule as opposed to the 0% that Selgin in that argument. That's probably where I would be, is that if we keep inflation low and stable, people tend to forget about it. Like I think over the last 30 years, the Federal Reserve has been in general pretty good at keeping inflation around their target of 2%. And I think people go about living their lives. And so I think they will still tend to, let's say, increase their demand for money if they're feeling uneasy about things. And it's kind of natural to maybe hunker down, so to speak, and have larger cash reserves if things in your life aren't going well, or you're fearful of losing your job, whatever the case is. I think people are still behaving that exact same way if we're having some sort of low and stable target of 2% as opposed to a 0% or possibly even deflation. So I think people are going to be, I think that argument goes away if we're not solving that problem, if they're really behaving the same way anyway. So that would be my two cents on that part. I think low and stable 2% doesn't solve Selgin's comment.
Well, low and stable 2%. I thought we were talking about deflation.
Well, no. And that's where I would come back to. That doesn't bother me either.
Yeah.
That people are going to still behave the same way regardless of where that is. Because if we had a deflationary period, it's still going to be stable, and it's going to be very low if it's negative. So the economy over the long haul here in the United States has grown from 2 to 3%, which means deflation is going to be negative 2 to 3%. It's going to be stable. It's not like it's going to be negative 10% and then positive 2% and then negative 20%. It's not going to be volatile like that. If economic growth is fairly slow moving ship and it's roughly at, 2 to 3% over time, the deflation of 2 to 3% is going to be similar.
So one thing I have with Selgin, I don't know how to say it, with Mr. S's argument is that the claim that wages are sticky, it always seemed to me like that wages are sticky because we have inflation. That's one of the reasons wages are sticky. And if wages are prices just like other prices, then should it be the case that the unit in which prices are denominated is worth more than people would accept a lowered wage? And I actually think you can see this, for example, with Bitcoin mining, which is deflationary in the sense that the reward that's paid for mining a block of Bitcoin, and mining a block of Bitcoin gets progressively harder over time, but the reward in Bitcoin that's paid for the block actually decreases over time.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Right? Every 4 years it gets halved.
Yeah, that's right.
And this hasn't resulted in a decrease in Bitcoin miners. In fact, it's resulted in an increase in Bitcoin miners. One of the reasons it's resulted in an increase in Bitcoin miners is because people know that even though the nominal amount that you are paid in Bitcoin is going down, the actual value of what you are being paid in terms of what you can buy with it is increasing over time. And so that's usually like my response to the stickiness thing is that, like you said, when you said, oh, well, it might not be the case that the depression is a result of deflation. Deflation might be a result of the depression. And it might also be that they one is, you know, a flywheel on the other, right? I think that's the case with the stickiness of wages too, that we have a, you know, 150-year history of monetary inflation. And so people expect wages to go up or stay the same. And so we have cost of living increases because the cost of living increases because there is inflation.
And then theories like rational expectations actually only support what you're saying, is that there's less stickiness. And I think generally economists agree that there's a lot less stickiness in 2020 compared to 1930, because people have information right at their fingertips, right? And we kind of the knowledge level is a little higher, so that if the government is doing something, they're not getting tricked as easily, and prices are more fluid, I guess, in general. So I think most economists would agree, if we compared a long span of time like that, that the difference between the lag time, which is what the stickiness part is, output prices, the prices on the stuff at Walmart change first, and then wages eventually change in the long run. Well, that distance between output price adjustment and resource price adjustment has definitely shrank. I can't believe I'd find an economist that wouldn't agree that that has shrank over time, which then gets rid of the stickiness problem that is part of the linchpin on that argument.
Yeah, so I'll make a few comments. I think to some extent, Justin's critique is accurate. I do think that there is an extent to which people like constant nominal prices. And I think that you see that outside. And again, this could be inflation driven too, but like we could see this in grocery stores too, that like according to economic theory and based on common sense, supply and demand should be probably changing all the time. But in reality, prices stay pretty consistent, you know, week over week, if not month over month. And so Armin Alshin is an economist who had a paper on this, who basically argued that the reason for this is that people prefer the consistency of prices to like market clearing in like a very strict sense, which I think is true. Like people would rather you have like some bulk inventory at a higher price, so that way they never show up to the store and like don't
and
get
it's not
their
there.
Milk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're all risk averse. So I think that that's proven.
So I think to some extent there's an issue there, but I'll also add another thing, which I don't think Selgin himself would necessarily disagree with. I don't know for sure, but for another piece of evidence against worrying about this like quote unquote bad type of inflation or deflation, is that bad type of deflation assumes that people, again, are going to change their supply or their demand for money radically. If you look at, like, I think the right measures, that doesn't happen. And so one way to measure people's demand for money is for how quickly they spend it. That's it's the inverse. That's what we call the velocity of money. And so one of the arguments that Keynesian economists will make is that velocity will very suddenly like drop or rise, and this will affect markets in a bad way. But if you actually measure money using what's called a Divisio measure, which we don't have to get into the details, it's too detailed for the podcast. But if you measure money according to a Divisio measure rather than kind of an outdated measure like M2 or something like that, what you find is velocity is actually pretty constant over the last like 50 something years. In other words, people don't suddenly change their demand for money.
And even M2 is, I mean, if you look at a table of M2, it's relatively constant.
Yeah, you get, what this spits out is that like people don't just randomly want different amounts of dollars. Right. And if that doesn't happen, then even Selgin would agree, then there's no bad deflation going on. And in which case, all of the deflation that has happened, which we haven't had any because of our inflation, but in theory, if we didn't have that money supply growth, then all the deflation that would have happened for the last 50 something years would be good deflation, right? So it might even be a moot point. It might be something that either it's in the past or maybe it was never relevant at all. But I agree that certainly it's secondary. But the reason why this matters, I think, is like we've talked a lot on this podcast about Bitcoin. And so like there is a fundamental maybe disagreement between like a Selgin type who thinks that there is a bad type of deflation, who wants to increase the money supply in response to that, and Bitcoin, because Bitcoin can increase supply. So I don't know, Justin, if you have any thoughts on that, do you see there being like a downside to Bitcoin being completely unable to increase supply, or do you see that outweighing all possible downsides, or there aren't any?
I think there are always trade-offs, right? That's, you know, that Thomas Sowell, you know,
there's no
No solutions, only trade-offs in social policy. But I think that the benefits of a fixed supply or a fixed rate of increase, which Bitcoin has asymptotically approaching a fixed supply of 21 million, I think those benefits clearly outweigh all of the, what's the opposite?
Potential drawbacks.
Clearly outweigh all the costs. I think it's really weird that people are so scared of deflation when it is something that when we see it in certain sectors, we applaud it. We go like, can you, like, isn't it great that you can get a flat screen TV today for, you know, $300 at Walmart? Yeah. And, you know, that was, I remember when, you know, those things cost $7,000. And we go like, that's great that that happened. And yet we're supposed to be like terrified that this could happen economy wide. And maybe you're right. Maybe people do like a, you know, at least some things having a fixed price. And it would be wild if every couple of years, the dollar store, you know, well, is the dollar, so is that, what is that for millionaires who has a dollar to spend? Yeah. You know, we need to rename it to the nickel store or whatever. Right. But those seem like small potatoes to me compared to the problems that you get with inflation. So I think that the erring on the side of deflation is much wiser, and that's why I like a currency.
So like listeners, Bitcoin. I hope you're convinced at this point and maybe scratching your head, why, oh, why would the bureaucrats in government want to have a positive inflation rate? And the answer is, it's an easy way for them to have more power and control more things in society. So if we have a 2% inflation rate, it is a tax on consumption. I think, listeners, you should feel this now, right? What happened 2 years ago? The government decided to pass out money like candy to all its citizens to help with COVID crisis. The government didn't have the tax dollars to pay for all that. So, of course, they had to issue more bonds and pile on more debt. And the Federal Reserve then purchased those bonds, which flooded the market with money, leading to 10% inflation. So guess what? That is a flat tax. Whether you're poor or whether you're rich, the 10% at the grocery store affected everyone equally. Who did it hurt the hardest? The poor. That's why I'm not an advocate of flat tax, which some economists are, but I'm not one of them. I think the rich should pay proportionately a little higher of their income in tax. And when we do government policy the way we did it with COVID and the way we've done it in the past, where it's inflationary or there's even just a regular positive rate of inflation, we are effectively taxing all the citizens equally. It's coming to you in the form of what you're paying at the cash register, and that's not fair.
Yeah, so again, Russ is providing, I think, like the anti-inflation view of why inflation, people who support inflation support their policies. I do want to provide like two other possible explanations that are, again, the Steelman explanations, which I think I generally don't like at least one of them. So the first one is this idea of, and you don't have to look this up, listeners, I'll explain in simple terms, but the zero lower bounds, right? There is an idea that the Federal Reserve can make our economy better if there's a crisis by lowering interest rates, because that increases like investment projects and stuff like that. And if your interest rate's already at like one or zero, you can't lower interest rates that much. And so if you have high inflation, then your nominal interest rate is also going to be high. In other words, if all prices are increasing by 3%, that means that your interest rate is a price. It's also going to be increasing by at least 3% on top of whatever the price already was. And so it gives the Fed more wiggle room to do things. Now, I think this is a bad explanation, because I don't think the Fed's very good at targeting interest rates in the first place. I don't believe that that's a system that they can effectively use.
Fatal conceit.
But also, even if they could, I don't think it would be good for them to do that either. So that's its own issue. Here's another argument, though, that's a little better, which is that inflation actually creates price stability, which sounds very funny, but here's the argument. The argument is that the CPI actually overestimates the amount of inflation in the world, because of quality improvements.
Yeah.
And so if things are improving in quality, then actually stable prices would mean a slow increase in the prices if we want prices to remain the same, which again, I know sounds crazy, but the idea is if your phone gets 2% better in terms of quality, a stable price would actually be a 2% increase in the price of the phone because you've got this 2% like higher quality phone, which should correspond with the 2% higher price. Again, I actually don't think this is a great argument because that begs the question, why would we want stable prices? Stable nominal, it's not even stable nominal prices anymore. Why would you want stable prices in the first place? And I think some of the things that Justin has said that leads us to think that like maybe decreasing prices would just be better than stable prices. But those are at least two of like the stronger arguments in favor of like a 2% target, which at the end of the day is arbitrary. And everybody who advocates for it basically knows that.
Right? Yeah. And an economist, I don't know if it was Friedman or somebody else, but they said prices are really a veil to the economy. The real economy is the trades we're doing. The fact that one phone will trade for two flat screen TVs, right? That's what you're making the choice of. I've got $2,000 to spend. I could buy two phones or one 80-inch TV. And so when the phone gets a little bit better, it just changes that trade-off, the choices that I'm making between various goods in society. And so nothing happens in absolute where the phone is better and its price should be better. It's always its price relative to other things in the economy.
What about the argument, and I think you've touched on this too, but just to make this explicit, the way you avoid having your wealth eaten in an inflationary economy is by investing it in vehicles that outpace inflation, right? So this is what you do if you are wealthy, right? And by, I don't mean like wealthy, wealthy. I just mean like you're taking in more than you're spending and you want to keep that wealth. What you do is you invest that. You get like a, you can either invest that in a, you know, a fund, or you can invest it in stocks, et cetera. One of the arguments, yeah, real estate. One of the arguments is this is good for the economy because absent this pressure, not as many people would invest. Mm-hmm. And so I think both of you have kind of touched on this a little bit in what you've said, but why is that not a problem in deflationary, in a deflationary situation?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I'll tackle it first, because this is a burr in my saddle too, that really investors are just trying to better themselves, right? We're looking out for our own self-interest and we want to preserve our wealth. We want to build wealth over time for retirement, for instance. And so really all you're doing is needing to beat the inflation rate, which is essentially what you're saying, right? If inflation's 2%, I need to earn 5% to earn 3% of purchasing power towards retirement. So now if inflation is 0%, I just know I need to earn 3% or 4% or whatever. So it's all just adjustable, driven by your desire to make your life better when you retire. And that desire is not going to go away. It's just inflation is this pesky little thing that we have to deal with that's out there to take into account. And the less we have, the less it matters, the better decisions we'll be able to make when we eliminate some of that uncertainty. And that kind of brings us down back to, I'll be able to better plan for retirement. The economy will operate better. People around the world will be able to make better decisions if we didn't have this pesky little unknown inflation factor that's driven through discretionary policy in Washington, D.C. If we didn't have that little pesky fly that we had to worry about, we'd have a lot more efficient decisions being made here in the United States and around the world. And so if it was negative inflation, right? If, holding on to money is good. It's a 2% by just holding money is what deflation would be, right? Hold on to my Bitcoin, hold on to my currency if it was actually deflating. But then I can do even better by putting this money to work. I can earn more than that rate of return. So you're always just dealing with inflation, whatever it is, whether it's negative, positive, or zero.
Yeah, I think Russ basically hit the nail on the head. It's like, this is a constant thing. It's not like there would be a one-time change if we changed our system, but not a permanent change. And the thought is here, if inflation, like Russ was pointing out, if inflation is 2% and the real growth of the economy is 3%, that means that the nominal growth of the economy is 5%. And so if you
invest in the economy, you're gaining 3% real terms. If you keep your money in your savings account, you know, you're losing on inflation. But then if we adjust that to where it's a 0% inflation compared to the economy growing at 3%, you're still losing out on that 3% growth, right? By keeping your money, you know, under a mattress or whatever, relative to putting it into the stock market or something like that. So I don't see this being much of a problem. Again, empirically, like the demands to hold dollar bills seems to be pretty stable. There might be some sort of like one-time shock, but kind of a tertiary thing on this is that just investing in creating jobs is not good. Like this is something else that we need to concede. Like putting money into the stock market for the sake of putting it into the stock market, that's not something that like is necessarily a good thing. Would we be better off if the government printed $2 billion and bought stocks with it? Because it would create all these jobs, right? The answer is no, because it would put money into a bunch of things that like otherwise would not be valuable for it to put money into. And this is going to create all sorts of distortions. And the same thing is true when you outsource this to like people. Like if people feel the need to like run to the stock market to invest in stocks, so that way their money doesn't lose all of its value or something, like you're either taxing them through the cost of them having to like determine what the best stocks are and stuff like this. In other words, you've got some what we call shoe leather costs, the real cost of trying to beat inflation. Or they don't do that research and they invest in a bunch of things that are not good investments, right? Mm-hmm. And this causes systematic problems down the line. And so either way, when you force people to abandon saving, and we could call this, it's not even real saving, it's like saving under the mattress. When you force them to abandon that in order to pursue some sort of like investment opportunity, it shouldn't surprise us if either it's costly for them to figure out how to invest the money or if they do it wrong. Like that seems straightforward. So no, I don't think this is a good argument in favor of inflation.
Yeah. Can I restate maybe what you said and you tell me if I have it right? That the way I phrased the objection was that people are investing because they want to avoid inflation eating their wealth. Mm-hmm. And the response was actually most people, the reason they invest is to maximize the value of their wealth over time. Mm-hmm. And that isn't going to change.
Right.
And yep. So they are still going to want to invest their wealth, regardless of whether or not there is inflation. And not only that, but if a high inflation rate does, and this is, I think, Peter's point, incentivize investment, it can incentivize investment in a way that might be counterproductive and not productive.
Yeah. And like one piece of evidence for the former too is that like if people really wanted to hold on to a stable asset that wasn't affected by inflation and not invest, they could still do that with inflation, right? Like people could, instead of going out and buying stocks, they could go out and buy gold, right? Gold is like relatively stable with respect to real goods and services. And so it's not like I'm not recommending it as an investment. The whole point is it's not an investment. It's like this relatively stable source of value. So if people were really attached to this idea of like saving under the mattress, they would put gold bars under the mattress. The fact that people don't alternate into that option when there's inflation says to me that like people aren't really doing that anyways. And like there's not that big of a crowd who is putting money under the mattress. And I think that's basically right.
So I got a couple closing comments. One is this, I hope that we've come to learn a little bit that decentralized decision making is so much better than centralized power at the government. This last case of COVID and the inflation that we got is a classic example. Listeners, if you got a $1,500 check and you went over the next couple of years and spent $15,000 at the cash register with 10% inflation, the government got it back that fast. They gave you money and then taxed everybody equally, and that money, that value is gone. So if you're like, oh, I really needed the help, I'm so glad the government gave me this $1,500 check, not recognizing that there's a direct connection between what the government policy was with the Federal Reserve and the government doing deficit bond spending and 10% inflation. If you don't get that, you don't know how screwed you got, because I think you are upside down with the gift that the government handed out versus the accumulative inflation that we're experiencing over this 2 to 4 year period. We easily are upside down on that. The government screwed us over. The last thing I wanted to say back to championing deflation is if there is anything with sticky wages, where wages adjust later than prices, deflation means you're winning, average person, because prices at Walmart are going to fall. And then your wage is sticky at its old value, and you actually gained purchasing power, right? If there's a little bit of a lag time, that's not my strongest argument with the whole thing, but, you know, because I'm kind of trying to throw the sticky wage thing out the window. But I think to the extent that there's a problem with falling prices, I just fundamentally disagree with it for all the reasons we talked about today. So
I want to bring back one thing that I think Russ mentioned earlier, which is like, why do they shoot for a 2% inflation? And the argument was like, well, that allows them to control more stuff, right? And so the argument is usually like 2% is the optimum. It does the thing that we want the monetary policy to do, because it, and then they list all these benefits for society. And I think that the argument ought to be, if it were honest, 2% is what we can get away with before people start to notice that we're
stealing. That's right. And that goes back to my comment of like, we can kind of live our lives and 2% is not, you know, if it goes up from $1 to $1.02, you know, whatever, I'm going to live my life and not worry about it. And you're absolutely right. It's optimal in the sense of that's what we can get away with. And now slowly but surely, I think the new target with what they're fighting today is like, well, 3% might be a better target. Well, there's some new arguments coming out that maybe a little higher would be okay as well. So, all right. Well, this has been a production of the Gordon Institute here at Ottawa University. I'd like to thank you all for listening. 5-star rating helps other people find us. Otherwise, please pass this along to friends and family that you might think would like to listen. Other than that, be fruitful and multiply. Thanks.